You should put this chair downstairs. Everybody would be liberated. So welcome. Hope that you guys are having some fun and some joy connecting and talking to each other a little bit. So one of the things that's been important to me and has been important to Cheryl, having sat so many of these retreats over the last 20-some-odd years, there's been something that's always felt to me somewhat rigid about the retreat culture. In some sense, I've always felt like the teachers were a little bit too hands-off. They kind of come in, and then they go, and you don't see them much. And so as much as we want to create a conducive experience for you, so keeping the days in silence is very good, and sometimes it can be odd to sit with somebody for a week and then break silence and, you know, say, hey, how are you? Thank you for the retreat, and then be gone. So I've always been, as a student, always have felt to some degree that Dharma teachers have been fairly inaccessible, which I don't want to contribute to that. So we're just trying to change things around a little bit to some degree so that the container and that the retreat feels more spacious and more at ease and more casual and more personal. And I hope that comes across in our teaching and our presentation. So I thought it would be maybe interesting or different for me to really kind of offer more of a, instead of a Dharma talk. I could happily give you guys a Dharma talk on the last night, but I feel like it's a little bit more useful sometimes to see maybe how I ended up doing what I'm doing. So what I'll do is I'll maybe talk for just maybe like 20 minutes or so. I'm not going to bore you guys with some big elaborate story, but to just kind of give you a little bit of my Dharma background and my life background and why this practice has been so important to me. It's really been the most important thing. Of all the things I've encountered in this world, this has been by far the most important and the most meaningful. And then after that, we can have a period of questions and answers. Hopefully, maybe some of the questions you have, I'll answer in my talk, and also just really an opportunity to ask me really anything that's interesting to you, that you're curious about. Maybe things I've said, things I haven't said, or maybe things that you know about me from the world of the interwebs, or whatever it is. Really, I'm pretty much an open book. I have nothing to hide. So I always have felt being transparent about your suffering and your joy and all of these things is good, because I'm a student of the Dharma first and foremost. This stuff is not easy for me. Just because me and Cheryl can explain some of this stuff in a meaningful way does not mean that we are particularly really great at it. There's an old saying, I believe, that goes, those who can't do, teach. I gave up on myself years ago. I mean, I'm rooting for all you. So my book's behind me, but I guess I don't need it. Any notes that are worthwhile? I don't need this. The Last Unicorn. So tonight I'm going to read you guys a story. Oh, that's good. So long story short, I had a really good childhood. Basically till the age of 11, everything was pretty good. And that is when I got introduced to this thing that people call trauma, which is not something new. People have been traumatized for thousands of years, but as many of you probably know, and some of you who do this kind of work, and whether you do therapeutic work or social work, and knowing that trauma has made it onto the landscape of being something that people really struggle with in a variety of ways. My sister was killed in a car accident when I was 11, and that really just destroyed me on some level. my sister was my, she was my older sister, and she was kind of my hero, but she kind of couldn't stand me because I was her annoying little brother. And she would, her friends were really important to me. She had, she was really, it was like 80s rock and roll, Joan Jett, Prince, kind of Boston rock radio. It was very iconic. So I've always been influenced by rock music and by rock culture and just American music culture. And I think I inherited that from my relationship to my sister. And I think to some degree I tried to keep the relationship with my sister going to some degree through my relationship to music, which has always been very important to me.
How old was she when she died?
15. Mm-hmm. Driving to school, car accident kind of scenario. She wasn't driving, she was a passenger. So that really threw me off. And I suffered, my teen years were the worst. And thank, I'm so glad I found drugs and alcohol when I was like 10 and 11. It was like so great. And I was drinking fairly regularly by the age of 12, which I'm told is not good. And started taking acid and doing drugs and really doing anything to escape my experience and really just trying to think about this linearly without being too linear is where I kind of got introduced to this idea that there was something wrong. There was something wrong about life. And that carried me to my teen years. And then luckily I moved to Western Massachusetts in high school. And I met probably the most important meeting of my life, one of my best friends, who I'm actually happy to see next week at my wedding. I met a kid named Hanuman Goleman, whose dad is Daniel Goleman. Many of you know him as the emotional intelligence writer. So he was one of my best friends. And I spent a lot of time at his dad's house where I met people like Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and Ram Dass. I remember we were tripping on acid at his dad's house. And we were downstairs and I wanted to go upstairs and make some tea. And he said, well, my dad's friend's here. And I said, who's your dad? He's my dad's friend Ram Dass is staying with us. And I'm like, Ram Dass? I'm like from blue collar kid from Boston. I'm like, fucking, who's Ram Dass? Whatever. I'm like, I'm not scared of Ram Dass. So I go upstairs to make tea and Ram Dass comes in the kitchen. And he's like, how are you? How are you? And I'm just like, I think he knows I'm tripping because he's Ram Dass. I don't remember what we talked about, but I remember going back downstairs and being like, your dad friend is fucking weird. So, but I had no idea about this kind of stuff. I had no idea about Dharma or Buddhism or anything. I just knew that there was something about Hanuman's family and his friends that was very attractive to me emotionally. This sort of non-judgment, the kind of kindness they had, the kind of inquiry they had. So I was very lucky to have that Dharma door. That was sort of my Dharma door. I didn't know that at the time. And then I became actually very positive. I was kind of a hippie for like 2 weeks. I was like, oh, life is good and everything's good. And I kind of came out of this depressed slumber in negativity and Motorhead, Metallica, you know, hold my breath as I wish for death. I remember hearing that and just being like, yes! You know that, right? Teen angst. And then unfortunately, I moved out of my parents' house and I lived in Northampton, Massachusetts, and I fell in love with this girl who I was living with, who was my roommate at the time. And we had a very, very short relationship, but it was very intense. At the age of 19. And I didn't really do romantic relationships pretty much pre-17. I don't think I had sex till I was 18. I just, that whole thing was just no way. I couldn't even do that. And we got killed. We didn't get killed. She got killed in a car accident. We were taking a walk and we got run down by a drunk driver. And so we got hit by this car. She got run over by the car. And I sort of came to and ended up finding the body dragged down the road, sort of gory, kind of like worst case scenario life experience. And that was really when, that was number two trauma, and that was really when I really feel like my somatic kind of hypervigilant. There was a massive karmic, sankharic installation that kind of entered my experience at that point. That was where the hypervigilance came online in a big way. And I don't actually remember much from, this was actually on September 11th, 1993. And from then till about November, I don't remember much, actually. I think I was mostly just very dissociative. I actually can't tell you much of what happened in that period of time. But I do remember two things happened. One, I went to Albuquerque, New Mexico, because Hanuman, my friend, was moving from Albuquerque back to Western Massachusetts, and his father, who was very kind to me, flew me out, and we drove back. Which was like this complete Cheech and Chong road trip. Like mushrooms and weed, and it was awesome. I don't remember much of it. And so he moved back, and I had really kind of formulated a very intimate relationship with his mom, who has his mom, Anasuya, who I think has, like, magic powers, actually. I don't believe in magic powers, but if somebody has them, she might. And after the accident, I think she was very much aware that I had some kind of massive experience that wasn't really going to serve me well, probably for the remainder of my days, had something not been done about that. And she suggested that I go talk to this man named Stephen Smith, who's actually taught here before, who was a Dharma teacher. She's like, oh, you should go meet. And that meant nothing to me. I was like, you want me to go talk to your Dharma teacher friend? Like, cool, like, bring me. Like, whatever, I don't care. And we drove to the Insight Meditation Society. I think it was right around New Year's. And it was me and Hanuman and Stephen Smith's daughter, who was going to school at UMass. And we sat in the IMS parking lot. The three-month retreat had just ended. So all the three-month retreat teachers were at Joseph's house. They were having, I think, a Thanksgiving meal, but it maybe wasn't Thanksgiving, but it was near then. And Stephen Armstrong was there, and Stephen Smith was there, and Sharon Salzberg was there, and Joseph Goldstein was there, and all these teachers that we know were there, and we were smoking tons of weed in the parking lot at IMS before we went into the house. And I remember walking into the house, and I was just like, everybody knows that we're high. But nobody seems to care. These people are great. And then I met with Stephen Smith the next morning to have a conversation. We actually slept at what's now the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies in the farmhouse that they had at the time before they opened that center. And that was probably one of the major, probably, experiences in my life that actually, like, completely, completely put me on an entirely different trajectory. And I don't remember what we talked about. In fact, I saw him in Thailand a few years ago and actually was talking to him about that conversation we had and what he remembered. But there was a couple things. There was a couple things that I do know happened that were fairly profound was that he heard my story in a way and reflected back to me that there was no doubt that I felt the way that I had felt. And he talked about suffering in this way that was very, very interesting to me in the sense of I had awoken a sense of wisdom. To some degree, the tragedy and the loss that I'd experienced was kind of a beautiful thing because now I was actually seeing the reality of what can happen as a human being. So sort of the heart breaking open into liberation rather than to collapsing into... So he offered this framework, which was very curious to me. And I felt like it was the first time in my life that an adult was telling me the truth about life. Which was very, very important. And then we met later on that day, and he said, well, you know, he said, your meditation practice, he talked about mindfulness, that it might be helpful, maybe I should try it or something. And so we went to the hall, and I'll never forget the initial instructions because I teach this stuff now. I actually mostly take it for granted, but I can tell you, the first time I actually took my attention out of my mind and brought it to the sensations of my in and out breath, and saw my mind wander and bring it back, and saw my mind wander and bring it back, sound familiar? That completely blew my mind. that I could actually find some degree of safety and ease, and I could kind of be okay for like maybe like 6 seconds. And I got introduced to the idea of the mind as the mind. Like, that is just the mind. This, the, all the fear and all the loss and all of the horrible things that you're experiencing, it's just in your mind. And that like calmed my nervous system down like to the nth degree. It was such a relief. Now, I wasn't any good at it. I'm still really not that good at it, but it just was like, it was such an exhale. It was like I'd been holding my breath for 18 years. And I finally went, and I could see there was some space after the out-breath. And I was like, oh, I could hang out here. And so I became very interested in Dharma, and I started sitting 10-day retreats, and I started working with Stephen Smith and his wife at the time, Michelle McDonald. They were my primary teachers really for about the next decade. And I really kind of got re-inspired around life again. And at the same time, I also developed this kind of punk rock, cynical attitude. I really was very much... So that was true. So I had this Dharma thing that was a massive relief to me, and I also had this part of my experience that felt like the world owed me. I felt very entitled. Not like entitled in the way that we think of it now, but I felt like existentially entitled. I felt like the world was going to pay me back for all the horrible shit that happened. And so I decided that I was, you know, going to have a career in music, which I ended up having. And so I spent 18, from years 18 to 28, having this, and back in 93, there were not a lot of 19-year-old kids sitting Dharma retreats. I mean, I'm still kind of the youngest person on retreat when I go to IMS. But back then, people would be like, they were just like, what is this kid? They thought I was somebody's kid. Like, is your mom here? I'm like, no, my mom's not here, I'm here. Stop fucking asking. So I had this dharmic kind of sensibility, but I also had this this drug addiction that was building, this alcoholism, this need to prove something to the world, this sense of being betrayed by the universe, this sense of being something being owed to me. So I also had this very sort of self-centered, entitled, really wanting to prove myself to the world. And I think a lot of that came from stuff with my sister around music and being teased and bullied in school. I had a really bad speech impediment when I was younger, and kids were really quite mean to me. I was going to show everybody. I kind of did, too, in a weird sort of way. I ended up just showing myself. So I had a very successful career in music. I lived in Boston. I had a great time from 18 to 28. I toured in bands. I put out records. I did drugs. I sold drugs. I drank, and I partied my ass off. And most of it was actually really great. And I would go to IMS in the summer and sit these 10-day Vipassana retreats. So I had this very dualistic thing going on. Part of me somehow knew better, but it was like too fun. You know, craving. I really actually thought the craving thing was going to pan out. I was like, I'm going to outsmart the Buddha. Craving doesn't lead to suffering. Not satisfying the craving leads to suffering. I really thought that. I was going to outdo. I was like, well, the Buddha, you know, he didn't make it as far as I'm going to make it. And so I got sober when I was 28. I can spare you the gory details, but I was in a very successful band. I was living in Europe and touring in Europe and playing concerts in front of 15, 20,000 people every other day, getting all the free alcohol, all the free drugs, participating in the underworld of Amsterdam lifestyle, which was not pretty, and just really, really like totally getting burned down on hedonic pleasure. Like just burning the house to the ground. And really was introduced to my favorite emotion, which is shame. I love the shame emotion. So I'm so grateful for shame, because if there was no shame, I would be dead. I'm so glad that we have shame in our system, because it was what allowed me to change. Just this kind of really like almost like pure, raw, organic, grass-fed self-hatred. Pure, uncut, just like the best. I just hate myself so much. But I knew better. I knew that there was this dark. I knew. And so for me, quitting drinking was just in getting. I quit drinking. I quit smoking weed. I quit my band. I just did it all. I just quit all of that stuff in one fell swoop and moved back into mom and dad's house at the age of 28. Which I actually recently just did not too long ago at the age of 43. I am not scared to move back in with mom and dad. But this time I brought my girlfriend and her son with me. My parents are the best. I'm so lucky. I've been so gifted with just really great parents. And I got sober. And I did something really insane. I got sober and I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous and I'd known about it for years. I knew that that was kind of where you go when the gig is up. And I went to AA and I was not impressed with anything that was being offered. And so I decided I would go to sit the 3-month retreat at IMS and just become liberated and live happily ever after. So with 60 days of sobriety, I don't know if anybody's ever been at day 60. It's not pretty. I went and sat for 3 months. Yeah. I did not become liberated. But it was really good. It was really, really good for me. I experienced moments of deep concentration, and I had a lot of really great meditative experiences, and I had moments of intense doubt and confusion. And I just kind of left that retreat almost dissociative. And I just had like literally no idea. And actually, that was when I was introduced to Noel Levine. There's a teacher named Spring Washam. Some of you know Spring Washam. She sat that retreat with me. And at the end of the retreat, she said, "Oh, there's this guy. He just wrote a book called Dharma Punks. His name's Noel Levine. You'd love him. He's lives in the Bay Area." And I was like, "Yeah, whatever. Cool." And then I drove back to my parents' house and I stopped at Amherst, Massachusetts to get a cup of coffee. Because I hadn't had a good cup of coffee in 3 months, and a book. And I went to the bookstore, and Dharma Punks was in the window of the bookstore. And I thought that was cool, because shit like that never happens to me. I've heard people talk about these things. I was like, "Oh, this never happened. This is cool. I'm going to get this book." And I went home and, of course, read it like 3 times and emailed Noah, and that was the beginning of the relationship I had with him. It wasn't much at the beginning. I think I emailed him, and we had a couple conversations, and he kind of just told me I probably should do AA, and he was kind of very Noah in that way of just like, "You don't know. You just sat for 3 months and you've been sober for 4 months and you're a mess. You're not ready." So I went and really spent the next 5 years. After that, I really actually kind of gave up on the Dharma. I'd sat that 3-month retreat. I'd been sober a year. Then I went and sat at the Forest Refuge for 2 weeks and actually left early. I left the retreat early and I was like, "You know what? This Dharma shit is for like well-adjusted white people and that ain't me." I was just like, "It's just not, it's not what I need." And I became very active in Alcoholics Anonymous for the next 5 years. And I didn't really sit at all. I still had respect for my teachers. And somewhere in my mind, I maybe thought the Dharma would be something that would be important to me again. But I really just like, I just needed to become a citizen. I started a concrete business. I got up in the morning. I went to work. I paid my taxes. I stopped lying. I got my mom a card for Mother's Day. Like, I did all the shit you're supposed to do. And it was really good for me. I actually would say that I learned Sila. We talk about Sila and ethics and integrity. I actually learned Sila in Alcoholics Anonymous, for sure. It was really, really good for me to have that spiritual program. And I still participate in that spiritual program, and it's been very important to me, not as much as I used to, but it's a really great sangha. You know, for those of you who are familiar with it or have had that similar experience. And then after doing that, I really wanted to play music again, so I built a house, and I got married, and I did all that stuff. I met my wife in AA, and then we moved to... In 03, I guess it was. No, not in 03. In 08. 2008, we moved to Nashville, Tennessee, which is where I spent about 7 or 8 years. And when I moved to Nashville, Tennessee, I had the trauma number three experience where my wife, we were there for like 3 weeks and she relapsed and started drinking and left me and we got divorced. Like, with my life, I moved to Nashville, Tennessee, and like the bad country song became my life. My dog died. It was just like, I did not appreciate the Merle Haggard iconic experience. And then actually my wife ended up getting murdered about 5 years after that. In an unsolved murder, actually very popular news in Nashville. It was a big, big deal. So I didn't know what to do. I wanted to play music, but part of the arrangement was that she had gotten a good job and I had supported her and she was going to support me so I could play music, but then she was gone and then I had to get a job and I didn't really have any money and I ended up working at a treatment center called Cumberland Heights, which is really what put me back into Dharma. I worked at a program called Cumberland Heights, which is a youth program for substance abuse, and I worked with adolescents and I had no idea what that was like. And I had been making $90,000, $100,000 a year pouring concrete in Massachusetts, and I was in Tennessee making, I think they started me at like $11 an hour. And I think I mentioned that the other night. So I just started being of service. I really actually felt like it was really healing for my internal teenager to work with teenagers. And I started teaching mindfulness. I introduced mindfulness to them, and I would start talking about Dharma a little bit, and then I got reconnected with Noah Levine and started training with Against the Stream, which I've mostly done for the last almost decade, I suppose. And so it was nothing that I ever saw coming. It was very strange that my Dharma life came back online in Nashville, Tennessee, which is not known for its Dharma institutions. It's like the buckle of the Bible Belt. So that was very interesting to me, of having that that re-arising of that experience. I started meditating again. After my wife left, I really started doing AA more aggressively, and I started meditating again. I started sitting retreats. I started studying. And I did 5 years of training with Against the Stream, with Noah Levine and Vinnie Ferraro, and towards the end, a little bit, Joanna Hardy now. Some of you probably know her. It started at an Against the Stream Nashville Center in Nashville, Tennessee. And I just had this very huge reemergence. I just really fell back in love with the Dharma in a big way about 10 years ago. And I've really been, hasn't really stopped since then. And I taught meditation and mindfulness and emotional intelligence. And I had to teach Dharma in a secular way in Tennessee because Buddhism basically is like satanic ritual and from a Tennessee perspective. You know, like for real. Actually, at one point, somebody at an AA meeting called me a Tibetan Buddha devil worshiper, which I thought was awesome. I was like, that's not what I am, but that is really cool. I'm like, where did you come up with that? And with that Southern accent. That Dave Smith, he's nothing but a Tibetan Buddha devil worshiper, what he is. Wow. I was so honored. And I taught meditation in prisons and jails and youth detention centers. I taught meditation for years for free in really, really gnarly places. I ran programs in a Tennessee State Prison for women. I ran programs in the jail. I had a program at this place called Healing Journeys, which is a substance abuse program in the jail in Tennessee for women, which is probably one of the best clinical programs I've ever seen, with a woman named Regina DeRiggi, who was a federal corrections officer from Utah, who was married to a cop who was the most right-wing woman with just the biggest liberated heart. She was the most confusing person I've ever met. Very clinically driven, really wanted to help people. You know, with the shotgun in the back seat of the car and the Trump sticker at the same time. Awesome. And her and I became very, very close. And they were doing a CBT program, cognitive behavioral therapy program. They didn't have anybody to do the mindfulness, so they brought me in to do the mindfulness. And the mindfulness wasn't working so good. So I started doing loving kindness practices and forgiveness practices and compassion practices, and had to report back to Regina, and she was like, listen, she's like, I don't care what you do. She's like, nobody cares what you do. This is jail. She's like, you want to teach Buddhism? Ain't nobody watching. She was totally cool. She's like, whatever you want to do in there, because it was working, and we started doing these heart practices, and I ended up working for an organization called the Mind Body Awareness Project, and started creating a bunch of curriculum around Dharma heart practices and trying to use secular language to teach Buddhism, very subversive in the Tennessee correction system, which was really fun for me. The subversive element has always been interesting. And then I ended up getting something that you clinicians might be familiar with, something called burnout and compassion fatigue syndrome. I got a bad case of the gas compassion fatigue, and ended up having a couple of pretty radical meltdowns. And for those of you who are in Nashville, ask Noah Rish about his birthday meltdown that I had about 6 years ago. It's a really great story. And I ended up, and that was really what got me into trauma work. And I've had one thing I want to say is I really feel like Cheryl says this sometimes. We all have weird luck. Like Cheryl talks about her housing luck. She's always had housing luck. And there's a Burmese teacher who talks about we all have sort of luck in some sort of areas, and we want to know what our luck is. I'm so grateful. I've had really great Dharma karma. I just feel like I've been so lucky in Dharma. I've always had really, really great teachers. They've always come right when I needed them. The Dharma framework has always made radical sense to me. I've been able to read things like the Abhidharma and just make sense of it like really quickly. I've had really, really great, my mind has just always been able to understand some of these ideas in a way that's been so nice, and it's come easy to me. It's been, most things haven't come easy to me. And then I started working and doing a bunch of trauma work. This guy who was coming to one of my meditation classes was married to a woman. Her name is Dr. Lee Norton, who's probably one of the most brilliant human beings I've ever met, who was a trauma therapist in Tennessee and worked on death row cases in Florida for like 30 years. And I was like, doesn't your wife like do something with trauma? Or he said, yeah. And she had come to a couple of my classes at Against the Stream. And so I started doing work with her, and I worked with her for maybe about 2 or 3 years. I still work with her. We teach together now sometimes. And I really, the trauma therapy work that I did, doing a lot of things like EMDR, and the thing that was probably most beneficial was I did this thing called internal family systems, which sometimes they call it parts work. And it's a meditative practice where you kind of go into a meditative state and you start to explore various, what I call dukkha sankhara, activation programs, wound that seeks the arrow. You start to be able to actually understand and see these processes in real time and actually change your relationship to them and dismantle them kind of in real time. It's very bizarre. But it completely knocked my hypervigilance out, and a lot of my post-traumatic stress symptoms basically went away. And she was all real, like, straight up about it. She's like, yeah, we'll just get rid of that. Don't worry about it. She was like a mechanic. She was like, yeah, we'll just fix your transmission. Like, don't worry about it. And I was like, what do you mean, fix my transmission? And she was like, well, your brain is basically broken. And we'll figure it out. We'll get it working good. And she did. I couldn't believe it. So, you know, one thing I like to make an argument for is when we try to start to unravel and overcome and work with our suffering, it's all not going to fit in one box. You know, those of us who get... The Dharma is not going to sort out all your problems for most of us. So I've always been open-minded about using various things. Therapy, experiential therapy, recovery, Dharma. I think we have to be very open-minded and not become too thinking that one, like mindfulness, is going to solve all your problems. Mindfulness is probably going to show you your problems a hell of a lot fixer than it's going to solve any of them. I think that I always like to make a plug for understanding that, you know, there's more going on, and to be open-minded to things that maybe sound stupid or silly or kind of against what you might normally want to do. And then I moved to Los Angeles after being in Nashville, Tennessee. Nashville, Tennessee was really great. I have nothing bad to say about it, but I think my time was just up. And I moved to Los Angeles, and I left Nashville, Tennessee in November 1st of 2014 and moved to Los Angeles very, very reluctantly. I didn't really know where I was going. You know, like sometimes you move someplace and sometimes you leave someplace. I didn't really move to LA, I just left Nashville. You know that kind of thing? Sometimes you move somewhere and sometimes you leave somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. And wasn't in LA very long and had kind of a very not great experience there. As a result of my time in Los Angeles, I'm no longer with Against the Stream, and I had to leave that organization for reasons that felt ethical and personal and very difficult for me to do that. I really actually don't have much of a relationship with Noah Levine anymore. And moved and met my partner Shannon, I'm getting married to next week, who I was in Against the Stream training with for many, many years. So we were very, very, very close, and I met her. She was married, and then she had a child, and then she got divorced, and then we dated for like 2 years, and neither of us knew that that's what we were doing. And one day she was like, you know, how about like you and me? And I was like, no way. And then about a month later, I was like, yeah, way. And so I was also, one thing I want to say is I also was in a very near-death motorcycle accident on October 15th of 2017. I was driving a motorcycle in Los Angeles, and basically a car pulled out in front of me, and I hit it, and I was in the hospital for about 6 to 8 weeks. And that was a really interesting experience. I don't recommend it, but I actually had many, many death experiences where I would be somewhere with friends. I actually, in my own mind, died many, many times. And I had a really deep sense of peace around it, of like, okay, like, my body is just not going to make it. And there's a lot of stuff I feel like I want to do. I don't really feel like I'm finished here, but I'm going to die, and it's okay that I'm going to die. And I would die. And then I would come back into some other kind of altered. I was in an ICU psychosis. I was on a fentanyl coma. I was tripping hard, but like unconscious tripping, which is way worse than regular tripping. And when I came to, sort of, it became very, very clear to me. I had this massive, massive reprioritizing of my values. And one of those things was knowing that I needed to leave Los Angeles. I needed to end my relationship with the Refuge Recovery Organization. And essentially, really, my main damage there with my relationship with Noah Levine really was pretty much destroyed. And I just knew I needed to leave Los Angeles, and I knew I wanted to move to Colorado. Like, it was just like, it was like a good drop-down menu of just like, dude, just do this. And I just did it. It was very, very, very easy. And so, you know, I will say a few words about, you know, teachers and kind of practice a little bit before I take some questions. I think we have to be wary. I think we have to be very aware of Dharma teachers and be aware of people who are in a situation like the one that I find myself in. And anytime we see somebody, because it's easy to fall into this trance because of what we're... It's not because of who we are. It's because what we're teaching is so fascinating and can really inspire us in a big way that a lot of times we can ascribe and project qualities onto the teacher that they don't actually embody. Mm-hmm. You know, if we look at human beings, this is kind of what we do, and this is the nature of destructive organizations and destructive religions and every religion and every institution that claims to have the truth of things all fall subject to this kind of experience. So it's not like, it's just a thing, right? We all know about this. So I've always had a variety of teachers. And when I think about Sangha, I think that I'm very skeptic, and I don't necessarily subscribe to the idea that you should take refuge in Sangha. Because Sangha is much of a Buddhist monastic tradition. Like, just because you go to a meditation center, if you go to, you know, Against the Stream in Santa Monica, it's not like joining a gym. You don't just join a Sangha and, like, everybody in the room is trustworthy. You know, you could be in East Hollywood or New York City. Any lunatic off the street could walk into a Dharma center. Well, you're going to take refuge in that person? So I've been really skillful and really weary about Sangha community. Is that you kind of have to create your own through your families, your friends, your therapists, your sponsors, the teachers who inspire you, the stuff that inspires you. You really have to kind of, I shouldn't say you have to, but I really feel it's important that we let the Dharma be our guide and let our entrust ourselves and to not put too much stock into anything external, anything external. So you mean I have a trauma therapist, I have a talk therapist, I have an AA sponsor I still talk to, I have a spiritual Dharma teacher, Stephen Smith, who I still talk to, who's sort of the person who I trust dharmically on a spiritual level. I have a right livelihood teacher, Stephen Armstrong has been very generous and has helped me kind of navigate what does it mean to be a Dharma teacher and how do you actually make it work? How do you support your family and how do you come to terms with Donna and how do you do this and how do you do it right? Because if I can't do it right, I'm not doing it. I'll go build houses in Colorado. Like, I got other shit I can do. If I can't do this right, then I'm not doing it. And I have a whole other bunch of Dharma teachers that I use for inspiration. I studied with Stephen Batchelor and some of the Buddhist teachers who are more of the academic. So I have like a whole, I jokingly say, I have a whole range of people in white coats and brown robes. I have like a team. And that's my Sangha. And so I've always been mostly inspired by the earliest Buddhist tradition, which is really what me and Cheryl have been teaching you, is the teachings that have been preserved in the Pali Canon, the oldest school of the Dharma, of Buddhism. And I have been, I hold the Dharma now more in a, I feel like it's something that I'm constantly in conversation with. I feel like it's almost literary in the sense of I'm always reflecting and questioning and the Dharma, the teachings become something that we just kind of find ourselves in conversation with. We don't have blind faith. We don't need to memorize. We're just kind of allowing it to guide us in a way that feels true and useful. And I don't know for how long I'll do this. I really have no idea what's going to happen. One thing that I do trust is I do trust the Dharma, and I really trust these retreat experiences. I've never I've sat many of them, I've assisted many of them, I've taught many of them. They always go well, right? It always, I just really trust the human potential that if we just sit quietly for just a couple of days even and just try to turn towards ourselves in a way that feels benevolent, like so much beauty will just, it just will happen, it just works, right? You know this, right? You've been here. It just works. It's so trustworthy. And of all the things that I've done and that I do that have been important to me, this is the most important thing to me. Sitting retreats, teaching retreats, sharing with people in this retreat. This to me is the best that we can do as human beings. So I'm really glad that you guys are here with me. And I talked longer than I wanted to. I'm sorry.